Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Media Roundtable, when we speak with journalists about coverage of this week's news. Now, this week, the 25th UN Climate Conference of the Parties wrapped up in Madrid, and it was widely regarded as a failure. The parties involved, including the United States, which technically is still in the Paris Agreement until next year, failed to come to agreement on key provisions related to international carbon markets. They also failed to step up the urgency of international action in the wake of yet more scientific findings and worldwide extreme weather events, which indicate increasing difficulty to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, along with the need to decarbonize the global economy by mid-century. The failure in Madrid, however, was punctuated by youth activism, including Time Person of the Year Greta Thunberg, who made their presence known by interrupting proceedings and generally describing the gathering as a, quote, PR campaign. So here to discuss coverage of the event is Ben Ehrenreich, a columnist at The Nation magazine and the author of several books, including his forthcoming Desert Notebooks, A Roadmap for the End of Time. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks, Ethan. It's good to be here.
And we're going to invite you to join the conversation. Our listeners, you can call in at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We'll open the phone lines up in just about 10 minutes, but you can send us an email now to yourcall@klw.org, or better yet, leave your comment at yourcallradio.org. So, Ben, we were actually both in Madrid for this 25th Conference of the Party Summit, COP25, as they call it. I was there on behalf of the Environmental Law Program at Berkeley Law, where I work for a day job. And in spite of the rise in coverage of the climate crisis in general, it seems that there was not a lot of coverage over this particular summit, at least not a lot of serious coverage. And I'm wondering if you would agree with that, and in general, what your take is about the significance of what just happened in Madrid.
Yeah, I think you're right. There wasn't a ton of coverage. And you know, part of it is that expectations were extremely low for this year's summit. And it says a lot that given the alarming number of disasters that we're seeing, on a weekly basis now, and the ever more alarming reports coming from the scientific community, that the pace of negotiations is such that everyone I talked to before the conference started said, "Oh, well, keep your, don't expect too much. It's going to be a very technical conference. There's just a few, sort of minor issues in the rulemaking for the Paris Convention that have to be worked out," and they couldn't even, in the end, come to an agreement on those. So I think it's pretty damning. And I think for a lot of people that I talked to, this really felt like, kind of the end of the road. And the only sort of bright side was that while the leaders of the world's governments were failing, and in particular the leaders of just a few governments who were sabotaging the process, the U.S. being one of them, that civil society and particularly the youth movement was really stepping up. On the first Friday of the summit, there was a march for climate justice in Madrid that organizers said as many as 500,000 people attended, just an enormous turnout. I think it's hard to remember sometimes that even just a year ago, that movement did not exist. Greta Thunberg's climate strikes, student strikes began a year ago, August. Extinction Rebellion also has only been around a year. So just in the last 18 months or less, we've seen this real explosion of popular momentum. And that, I think, is the other story coming not just out of Madrid, but from all over the world.
Yeah, that was my impression as well, being there. I've only been to one other conference of the parties. That was back in Paris in 2015, but it was very striking to see the number of youth activists running around the conference site. And I do want to get into that, but first I have to follow up on your comment about the failure of this conference to come to any sort of agreement, even on the technical rules. Can you describe a bit about why that failure happened? What was responsible for the outcome that we saw there?
I think, you know, it failed on three counts. The first was, as you mentioned, the rules for creating a carbon market, which was the one bit of the Paris Agreement rule book, which still had to be worked out.
And the carbon market, just for listeners, can you describe just what was on the table there?
Yeah, carbon market is basically a way to involve private enterprise in this whole deal by giving credits to it can be done a few different ways. California, of course, has a cap and trade program, which is one of the possibilities. But basically, polluters will pay if they in order to release emissions, and they can also get credits, which they can then trade on a market. And you know, this could either be a way of really regulating emissions in the private sector, or it could function as a gigantic loophole that would prevent the private sector from having to really do anything. You know, by creating all kinds of opportunities for double booking, for as I'm sure you know, having watched this process a bit, it is absolutely stunning what happens in this, you know, incredibly technical language that mere mortals can't really understand. That the difference of a few words in sentences that are written, really written, so that unless you have years of experience, you know, in climate jargon, you just won't understand them at all. These can make the difference between a program that has some teeth to it and one that is completely useless and makes the entire Paris process irrelevant. And when we have something as crucial at stake as, you know, really the future of the planet, that's all pretty stunning.
No, I think that's an excellent summary. The very technical, easily gamed, a lot of controversy around carbon markets. So I think some people, myself included, think coming to an agreement on carbon market rules may not be that big of a deal. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, most of the climate advocates and activists I talked to were in agreement that having no agreement on climate markets was actually much, much better than having a bad agreement on climate markets, because a bad agreement could really sabotage the entire process. And, you know, it should be said, to give credit where credit is due, it was the U.S., it was Canada, it was Japan, it was Australia, it was mainly the wealthy countries that were, and as well as Brazil, that were really doing their best to prevent, you know, to insist on rules that most of the rest of the world was absolutely unwilling to go along with.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking about the causes of the failure. So, you know, one hand, it was a carbon market, but I didn't mean to take you off track. So interested in your further explanation on why an agreement wasn't able to be reached.
You know, on that, and I think on the other main issues, which we can get into if there's time, it is, you know, all extremely technical. It was a few countries, mainly the wealthier countries and the countries with large emissions. So we're talking about the U.S., we're talking about Canada, we're talking about Australia. To a lesser degree, we're talking about the EU, we're talking about Brazil, India, and China. On various issues in different ways, getting in the way of any agreements that would have really limited their ability to keep doing exactly what they're doing right now, which is releasing you know, emissions numbers are going up in most of those countries every single year. And so I think most of those countries were working to, as you said, to game the system, to make it look like they were doing something that would just allow them to go on with business as usual, while the rest of the world and, you know, particularly poor and vulnerable countries, which are being hit hardest by the climate crisis in a really existential way, were fighting as hard as they could to introduce some rules that would actually protect them. And that would create, you know, changes to the economy and changes to the way all of us live our lives, that would prevent, you know, entire societies from being destroyed within a few decades.
So I mean, what you're describing sounds like a very dysfunctional process. I mean, I definitely would agree, you know, based on what I saw, the big polluters are blocking comprehensive action, and status quo just seems to be, you know, moving forward without any prospects that things are going to change fundamentally. So what is the future for these UN gatherings? I mean, is there any light at the end of the tunnel with these gatherings? What can we look forward to at best, or what should we be looking to as an alternative?
Well, you know, I mean, this was the 25th Congress of the Parties. This has been going on for 25 years. And in that those 25 years, they've produced the Paris Agreement, which, of course, the U.S. has pulled out of, which most people agree is, woefully inadequate. That if we stuck to the current targets in the Paris Agreement, we would end up with 3.2 degrees Celsius of warming by the end of the century, which would be an absolutely disastrous outcome. So I think when you have I should also say that most countries are nowhere close to meeting their Paris goals. So they've come up with an agreement which is inadequate, which no one is doing anything to meet. So really, I think Greta Thunberg is correct that after all these years of negotiations, they have accomplished, you know, something close to nothing. And I think it's time to ask, after 25 years, as emissions continue to go up without any kind of agreement that is going to change things, if this process is really even about limiting emissions. And I think at the moment, it's pretty clear that it isn't, that whatever's happening there, we can't just say that there were kind of accidental breakdowns along the way when it's been going on the same way for 25 years. So I don't have, they were unable this year to come up with even a strong statement going into next year's meeting, in encouraging countries to raise their levels of ambitions for their targets of emissions cuts for next year. So they couldn't even agree, we're going to try to do better. They couldn't even agree to put together a statement that said, we're really going to try. Even that was too much. So all of that is pretty damning, I think. Next year is the year in the meetings in Glasgow next year where they are supposed to deal with more substantive issues. They are supposed to raise their targets. They're scheduled to change the targets, commitments that they've agreed to from Paris. There's no sign at all on the horizon, I think, that most countries are going to be willing to do that. And I think there are plenty of signs that the major polluters are going to do everything they can to prevent that from happening. So I think putting one's faith in this process is a mistake. And I think the only thing that I think can get us out of this is an enormous levels of popular mobilization to put pressure on governments to make really serious commitments and changes, which is just beginning to happen, but it's not happening enough yet.
Yeah, well, we certainly did see some of that mobilization, as you mentioned, at least in the halls and, of course, on the streets of Madrid, where I know that you're calling in from this morning, so we appreciate that. I also want to open the phone lines up to listeners. If you'd like to call, join the conversation. If you attended the conference in Madrid or monitored what happened at the UN conference there, we'd love to hear from you. We also want to hear from you if in next year's presidential elections, environmental issues and climate change are going to loom large and how you'll be voting. To join the conversation, you can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Again, that's 866-798-TALK. Well, Ben, I wanted to ask you about the dynamics of the U.S. presidential election, how that might affect the U.N. climate conferences. Now, we know that we're going to have a big presidential election next year. Was there a sense that maybe these delegates at the U.N. climate conference essentially should be waiting to see if we get a new president? Now, a new president could get us back into the Paris Agreement within 30 days. So the U.S. could be right back in and asserting leadership once again on these international climate issues. Do you think that was a dynamic that was at play? Let's sort of punt until maybe the U.S. changes its tune, or are we overstating the impact of the U.S. in these negotiations?
I don't think we're overstating it, but I think we have to be a little bit careful because Trump, I think, has been absolutely, you know, it's hard to underestimate the damage that's done by actually, you know, pulling the U.S. out of this entire process. And it should be said that pulling the U.S. out of Paris does not mean that the U.S. was absent there. The U.S. was there and playing a, you know, a really obstructive role throughout and trying to make sure that even though it's not going to be part of the Paris Agreement, that it still has say in the rules of any climate regime that the international community, you know, settles upon. So, you know, Trump clearly wants to be out of this, but also to still be able to control it and to mess it up. So, you know, that is kind of his reelection would certainly be the worst possible outcome. The U.S. is still, you know, the second largest emitter, the largest historical emitter of carbon, you know, on the planet. The absence of the U.S. in any process would be, you know, devastating. That said, I think it's important to acknowledge that the U.S., even under before Trump, under Obama, has a pretty dodgy history in these negotiations. And historically, under both Democratic and Republican administrations, the U.S. has not acted in particularly good faith and has done everything it could to avoid any strict restrictions on its emissions, has certainly done everything it could to avoid having any kind of real mechanism that would make richer countries help poorer countries to pay for the effects of climate change on their societies, even though, of course, it's richer countries that are the ones that are doing all the emitting and that are profiting from it. So I think, you know, it really depends who is going to be elected if it's not Trump. And I won't get into the primary politics too much, but I think it's pretty clear already that some of the Democratic candidates have much stronger climate programs than others. And it's certainly not the case that having a Democrat in office is going to mean an absolute turnaround on climate change. I think there are this at least one and maybe even two candidates that I think could really make an enormous difference. But that's not true for the entire field.
Do you want to share who you think those candidates are?
You know, I think Bernie Sanders certainly has the strongest climate plan. And I think that would be a real change, a real game changer if he were to be elected. I think if for instance, Joe Biden were to be elected, you know, I'm sure he would probably go back into, you know, return to Paris. But it's hard to imagine that there'd be an enormous difference in the trajectory of U.S. negotiations than there had been, for instance, under Obama. And that was not, you know, that would not get us out of this crisis at all.
All right. So people who care about this issue should be looking at the candidates' different pledges and plans on climate. And if you're just joining us, this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're talking about the UN Climate Conference in Madrid, which ended in what was widely regarded to be a failure. And we're joined by Ben Ehrenreich, a columnist at The Nation magazine, the author of several books, including the forthcoming Desert Notebooks, A Roadmap for the End of Time. And he joins us from Madrid, where he's still located after the end of the conference there. Well, Ben, I wanted to go back to your comment about the sort of rise of youth activism that you and I both saw in the hallway at Madrid, and you know, there was some pretty heartbreaking quotes from some of the activists who were attending. One Australian activist wrote in The Guardian that, quote, "This was the first annual climate summit where the general mood was panic and climate grief. It's the first COP, Conference of the Parties, where I've seen tears in the meetings and the corridors at the terrible impotence of not knowing how to grasp the power back from the big polluters." Was that your sense from the activists that you spoke with? What was their general tenor and tone in the hallways there in Madrid?
You know, I certainly felt that, and the grief and the sense of, you know, outrage and impotence and frustration were all strong. But what was remarkable to me was the other side of that, which was that you really saw people feeling their own strength and feeling the strength that they get from solidarity. I talked to as many of the youth activists as I could. These people from all over the planet. I spoke to kids from Chile, kids from Uganda, kids from Sweden, kids from the U.S., kids from Canada, and a lot of them had been in touch, over social media because they're teenagers and they're good at that. For many months before this, but they were actually meeting each other for the first time and standing together for the first time. There were actions inside the halls as well as the big, protest that we talked about in central Madrid. There were a few smaller actions where they tried to make sure that the delegates to the convention got their message in a much more immediate way. In one of those incidents, a couple hundred people were pushed outside of the halls by UN security and sort of, pushed out into the cold so that the summit could go on. I think all of that had a pretty powerful effect on those kids. That doing things in their own cities was one thing, but standing together with these kids from all over the world raising their voices together was a powerful experience for them. And I think that, I think there was also a lot of movement building happening there. And that gives me a certain amount of hope that they're going to come out of this, angry. I think anybody who pays close attention to this feels real despair at times. But also I think that they're going to feel empowered by their own solidarity. And I think more of us could probably learn from that.
And they were definitely led by Greta Thunberg, the Swedish teenage activist we've been discussing. And she was just during the beginning of this conference named Time Person of the Year. And I know that really irked the president, who's always seems to be, wanted to be the person of the year every year, at least in his own mind he is. And what impact did you find that she made? I mean, I saw her running around the conference halls, and she was as close to a rock star as you could find at a climate gathering. Everyone was like paparazzi around her. What was your sense of her impact there and her ability to sort of marshal media coverage and symbolize, the sort of youth frustration and despair and anger over what older generations have done?
She gave another very powerful speech on her own. But I think the thing that was most impressive and exciting to me was the degree to which she was stepping back from the spotlight to give space over to other voices. She did the first event she had at the conference. She barely talked, and she gave this, the stage over to indigenous activists who the media normally completely ignores, and made sure that they were the ones whose voices got heard that day. And of course, when the media reports on this, they mainly report, Greta Thunberg steps aside so that other people can speak, and then they don't necessarily say what the other people said. But I think nonetheless, she's just coming off of this tour of North America. She went to Standing Rock. She spent a lot of her time in the U.S. meeting with indigenous activists, learning about grassroots fights in different parts of the U.S., and really just kind of listening and observing things that it wouldn't have been possible for her to learn if she had stayed in Europe. And my sense is that had a real impact on her. Her Twitter feed has kind of changed. And I think the way she dealt with this, this year's climate summit compared to last year's has really changed, in that she's doing what she can to use her celebrity to broaden the movement and make sure that indigenous voices and voices from, from not just the EU and the US, but from Africa, from Latin America, are getting heard, because these are the people who are most immediately affected by the crisis.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are just about running out of time, Ben, but I really appreciate you coming on and offering these thoughts. I mean, from my own perspective, having been with you there, although we didn't run into each other at the Madrid UN Climate Conference, I think that these UN processes certainly are important, but at the same time, I think the real action is going to take place at the nation different level, maybe at gatherings like the G20, where you have the 20th largest polluters essentially around in the globe, who are responsible for about 75% of emissions. So maybe at these smaller gatherings, we'll see more progress. And certainly at state level jurisdictions where they control electricity grids, local levels where we control land use policies, sprawl, transit, that sort of thing. So, you know, as important as a UN climate conference can be, and it's hard to imagine a world where we don't have it. At the same time, I think the real action always was going to be taking place at the local levels. And Ben, I appreciate you coming on, sharing your thoughts. And this is Your Calls Weekly Media Roundtable. Ben Ehrenreich from The Nation magazine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Ethan.
And enjoy the rest of your time in Madrid. We'll be back just after this break. All right. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Weekly Media Roundtable. While we're podcasting the show, you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Well, we're going to transition to our second topic of this weekly media roundtable program. After nearly 3 months of public hearings, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to impeach Donald Trump on Wednesday night for abusing the power of his office and obstructing Congress. He is the third U.S. president now to be impeached in the history of this republic. And by all accounts, the next step in the process will be a trial in the United States Senate, where he will need two-thirds. He will have to get less than two-thirds votes in order to avoid conviction and removal. But questions remain as to when that trial may actually happen. So to look at the coverage of this historic vote and the role of the media in covering the impeachment story in particular and the Trump presidency in general, we're joined by two guests. Michael Winship is a senior writing fellow at the website Common Dreams and longtime Bill Moyers writing partner. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And we're also joined by Dan Frumkin. He's a founder of Presswatch, a media project that monitors political reporting and encourages more of it. Welcome, Dan.
Well, and thanks so much for having me.
So we're excited to launch into this topic, but I want to let listeners know you can join the conversation. We'll open the phone lines up in about 10 minutes. The number to dial in and ask questions of our panel is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or you can send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Well, as I mentioned, on Wednesday night, the House voted 230-197 to impeach Donald Trump for abuse of power. They voted 229-198 for obstruction of Congress. And the next step now is to go to the Senate following a trial to take place. But given the Republicans' slim majority and the fact that Senator Mitch McConnell, who's the Senate Majority Leader, has already boasted that he's closely coordinating the planning of the trial with the White House, it's now dubious that the House is Majority Leader, that Nancy Pelosi, and Speaker of the House, is going to necessarily send over these articles of impeachment. So there's a lot happening here. And Michael, let me start with you on this. What is your take on what happened on Wednesday night? How do we get to this place, and what's going to be happening now going forward in the near term here?
Well, I'm one of those people who tends to feel that Donald Trump in this case is like John Wayne at the Academy Awards. You know, he won the Academy Award for True Grit, but it was really for the entire body of his work. I feel that the House successfully impeached Trump on those two counts Wednesday night, but that in effect they were actually also going after him on a number of other things, from the obstruction of justice issues that were raised in the Mueller report and various involvements with Russia and other acts which I would deem impeachable.
Although they kept the articles pretty narrow, correct? The articles themselves are pretty narrow.
Yes, they are. They are indeed. But I think we won't see anything until the House comes back in on January 7th, and at that point is when determination will be made. I believe, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that legally they have to turn the articles of impeachment over to the Senate by the day after they come back into session.
So, Dan, what's your take then on the sort of formal process that has to happen going forward here now?
Yeah, I'm a little bit unhappy that the coverage has turned so quickly to the logistics of what's going to happen exactly. It's like we spent about 2 hours paying attention to the fact that the President of the United States had been impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. And then it was off to the next story, and I think we need to sit and think about this a little bit more. I think that Michael's exactly right. This was part of an indictment of a presidency that has committed many crimes, I just think we should talk about that more rather than moving on to this sort of these minor issues.
And so, Dan, your take on the coverage is that we're not fully delving into the actual high crimes and misdemeanors that the House is accusing the president of committing. You think there should be more coverage of what actually happened?
Yeah, and I certainly hope that reporters also don't stop digging into the story just because the vote has been taken. There was a fascinating story in the Washington Post this morning, which I thought potentially advanced the story a lot, basically quoting a bunch of anonymous White House officials just saying that they were very concerned that Putin had basically put this idea in Trump's head, that Ukraine was behind the election interference. And I mean, the good news is this wasn't a great investigative story, also a classic example of when you do want to grant sources anonymity because they're telling you something that the White House wouldn't want you to know. But I also thought it suffered enormously from the fact that these forces were anonymous, and so it's not the kind of story that other news organizations are going to match necessarily. It fails to sort of capture the public's imagination. So anyway, but the point is, yes, I think that we need to sit here and think about what this really means to our country a lot more than we have.
And Michael Winship, to turn to you, I mean, I think Dan's point is a good one, that there could be much more in-depth coverage of what's underlying it. But at the same time, it's I think what's shocking to a lot of people is just how insulated, you have Trump supporters in terms of, feeling like this is a big deal, really even accepting any of these facts, compared to those in support of impeachment who seem to see pretty clearly that these are pretty grave offenses committed against our democratic institutions or democratic processes. So even with more coverage, do we feel like that will sort of help bring any of these sides together, or does something else need to happen?
I think we just have to keep pushing ahead, and just as Dan said, we have to keep revealing and talking about these other things that are coming up. He mentioned that piece in the Washington Post about the concern about Trump being overly swayed by Putin, to the extent where he was saying, Putin told me this. I believe this because Putin told me. And also in the Post today, there's an interview with Adam Schiff in which Schiff is talking about how they're continuing to try and get hold of the documentation and continuing to get different witnesses to come in, and they're going to keep up that fight. I think that Schiff's been very clear from the beginning that the investigation is far from over, that they're going to keep pushing on this. And one of the other things being this whole another Washington Post story that came out a couple of weeks ago about the fact that there is the White House had done an in-house investigation, gathering together all the documentation of how the White House had post the July 25th phone call with Zelensky and Trump, had spent all this time coming up with rationalizations to basically try and cover the president's rear end as to what had really happened.
And I'm going to open the phone lines now. If you're just tuning in, this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable. We're discussing the impeachment of President Donald Trump for abusing his power of office and obstructing Congress. That vote just took place this week in the U.S. House of Representatives. And we are joined by Michael Winship, senior writing fellow at the website Common Dreams and longtime Bill Moyers writing partner, and Dan Frumkin, founder of Presswatch, a media project that monitors political reporting. If you'd like to call to join the conversation, the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We want to hear from you, what you thought about the impeachment hearings and the coverage. Do you think the media did an adequate job in emphasizing the facts and who is telling the truth? You can call again at 866-798-TALK or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org, or email us at yourcall@klw.org. Dan Frumkin, I want to ask you about a common refrain that you hear, particularly from Republicans defending Donald Trump. And I think Adam Schiff summarized this in his final speech before the vote on Wednesday night, which is basically, who cares? Why does this matter? And that seems to be the common refrain that you hear from Trump supporters. What's your response to that, and what role could the media play to address that basic question?
Well, I think you're right. That is fundamentally the Republican position. I thought it was fascinating that very few Republican House members actually said that during the debate. They tried to claim that nothing had happened, and that this is all about Democrats being angry at Trump for other reasons. And I do think that their ultimate argument, which is at least a logically consistent one, is we just don't care. And I think that the jury's out as to how significant that's going to be in the long run. Your point before about whether people will sort of believe or take this impeachment issue seriously in the long run. Think about Bill Clinton. I don't think you heard that much about his impeachment during Hillary Clinton's presidential run. People have sort of edited out of history, and I think a large part because a lot of people have realized how spurious it was, how silly it was, and how partisan it was. So, interesting question. Will that be how the Republicans think about Trump's impeachment 10 years from now or going forward? And how widely spread will that feeling be? And there is where it's important for the press to continue to point out the distinctions between a crime that involved tremendous abuse of power and obstruction of justice, and one that involved lying about sex.
All right. Well, certainly a lot of comparisons now being made between those impeachment proceedings. I think your point's very well taken. So let's go to the phone lines. We have Mark in Berkeley calling in. Welcome to your call, Mark.
The show. I was just wondering if the guests have any suggestions on how to get the Democrats to pay more attention to election integrity. I mean, we already know that they're canceling voter registrations. Can't be legal in many states. And we also see now increasing gaps between the exit polls and the vote counts. A lot of this after the Help America Vote Act. But the Democrats are not paying any attention to it, and it seems like the Republicans have like a minority permanent, rule now. And so since we see them doing all these other shenanigans, I think we need to be paying more attention to the integrity of the vote, custody of the ballots, witnesses, the entire deal. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mark, for that question. Well, Michael Winship, let me first direct Mark's question to you. Can the Democrats walk and chew gum here? What are they doing on election integrity, and what role could the media play to ensure that we have a strong and secure electoral process?
Well, I think that things. I think part of the problem is that the fact that, that there are things going on to combat this has been sort of lost in all the coverage of the impeachment and so forth. And there are things going on. And certainly, Stacey Abrams in Georgia and former Attorney General Eric Holder are very much involved in efforts to try and make sure that there is integrity in next year's elections. I think part of the problem in terms of the Democrats is that for a long time the Democrats were not paying sufficient attention to the local legislatures, the state legislatures, and so forth, in which so much of this takes place, so that the Republicans got control of a lot of state government that has created a lot of these problems. And I think that they realize this now and are working to change that. I mean, you saw it happen earlier this year with the Virginia state legislature and so forth. So I think that's part of it, but so that more has to be done, but it's not to say that nothing's being done. Mm-hmm.
And Dan Vrimkin, your take on coverage of this particular story, do you see it related to impeachment?
Yeah, I think the Democrats made a big mistake in not expanding on the notion that our elections are under attack, and that foreign interference was only one of the many ways in which Republicans are trying to affect elections in ways that aren't appropriate. And I do want to pick up on what Michael said, that there are a lot of exciting movements at the state level. I think a lot of people in this country have basically given up on the federal government being of much use here. In the 2018 election, you saw some ballot measures in half a dozen states that about issues like gerrymandering and so on. And so I think people who want to solve this problem should feel empowered to act locally, and I think they'd find a lot of other people feel the same way.
All right. Well, I want to thank Mark for that question. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have Alexis in San Francisco dialing in. Alexis, welcome to your call.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. With the astonishing amount of evidence, I really was trying to be open to listening to the other side as best I could, and I just felt like it was basically they turned black into white and white into black. Even just if you think he's innocent, the level of details that would make him suspect, all the hiding the records in the top secret computer servers, the text messages that said, oh, so now we're trading military aid for political elections. Just endless evidence. And also, do you agree with that, that there was kind of this watering down of those kind of hard facts that are really hard to refute in these hearings? And second, I still think that him not releasing his taxes is tied to all this. I know that's kind of a dead horse, but I'm still really upset about it.
All right. Well, Alexis, thank you. Let me let Dan Vrimkin weigh in on your question, both points you raised, particularly the one about these facts that do seem pretty clear cut, but yet we seem to be somehow numb to them as a whole, and maybe numb to the presidency in general at this point. And so, Dan, I'm curious your response to Alexis.
Well, I think she's exactly right that people are numb. I think that I blame the media. I really feel like a lot of the coverage by the mainstream news organizations that we generally, we would normally turn to for trusted information have been trying to sort of split the difference. And so when you read an article that has one paragraph about what Democrats say, and those happen to be mostly facts, and another paragraph about what Republicans say, and those are bizarre lies, distortions, and conspiracy theories, I think that the press is very much engaged in confusing the public rather than informing it.
And Michael Winship, I want to let you have an opportunity to respond to Alexis as well. Any thoughts for her?
Well, in all candor, I couldn't hear her very well.
Well, so
she what she said.
Sure. Well, I can just restate just briefly. She was summarizing just her take on the impeachment proceedings that we saw, the hearings that we heard, and just how cut and dried some of these facts were about trading foreign aid, military aid for foreign interference, electoral assistance for the president's reelection campaign, and just wondering why it is that these facts don't really seem to be penetrating.
I think, you know, I think part of the problem, and first of all, I totally agree with what Dan just said, and I also think that, you know, part of the issue goes back to the Mueller report, because the Mueller report was talking about a number of different things which people found hard to totally understand, because it was in such a massive report, and also you had that terrible move twice by Attorney General Barr to basically try and shape the narrative in Trump's direction, which really screwed things up. So there's been this attempt now. Part of the whole point of the Ukrainian story has been that they felt that there was a simpler narrative than the things that Mueller was going into. But I think it is still complicated for people who don't have the opportunity, who just are so busy with their lives that they can't sit and either watch the hearings, which I thought were overall quite devastating, or read the transcripts, or even read the newspaper accounts of it. And part of it, as Dan said, is also just there is just so much of a media universe now that is hammering away at this that it's hard for people to digest. You know, as they say, drinking from a fire hose, it's very, very hard for people to comprehend everything that's going on.
Right, well,
I'd like to add that Trump's gaslighting has been enormously effective here.
Yes.
He says, read the transcript. And if you do read the transcript, it couldn't be more clear what's going on.
It's not really the transcript. I mean, there's a summary of what they say the conversation was, but we haven't actually seen a real transcript.
Well, so if you're just tuning in, this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable. We're discussing the Trump impeachment in the U.S. House of Representatives, the vote that took place this week, and the media coverage of it. We're joined by Michael Winship, senior writing fellow at the website Common Dreams, and Dan Frumkin, founder of Press Watch. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. I want to bring on the line Greg from Palo Alto. Greg, welcome to Your Call.
Hello. Couple of comments. One, I think the Democrats made a serious mistake in limiting this. I'm sorry about my feedback. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Just turn down the radio.
I'm having trouble hearing him, actually.
Hold on just a second, then I'll turn it down.
Okay. we'll give Greg a second here to turn it down. And Greg, are you back?
Sorry about that.
No problem.
Okay, so the question I have is this. I think that the Democrats made a serious mistake. I think your guests have covered this. And at least not going with the Mueller report. I think there's just numerous examples that Mueller pointed to. He did it. There were crimes, including obstruction of justice, that the Democrats could have relied on because the Republicans already said, hey, there's no crime here. Well, Mueller gave them the road path, and they should have followed that. But my more important issue is this. It's the role of McConnell in all of this. I mean, McConnell has already made it clear that he's not going to act in an impartial way. And I think that I don't know how much leverage the Democrats are going to have over trying to get a reasonably fair trial, if you will, in the Senate. And the thing that really amazes me about McConnell, I'll try to end this on this, is that he has been so far to the right on issues going all the way back to Merrick Garland and his, you know, not even giving Garland a hearing for the Supreme Court, that, you know, I can't understand how the Senate leader has that kind of power to be able to stifle legislation, block a Supreme Court nominee, and now basically ensure that there's not going to be an impartial trial in the Senate.
All right, Greg, I think you're raising an important point. We talked about this at the very beginning here, but this is a critical factor going forward now. What leverage does the U.S. House have, does Nancy Pelosi and the majority that voted in favor of impeachment have, to ensure that there is more of a fair trial in the Senate, that that witnesses will be called, et cetera? So, Michael, let me start with you on that. How do you respond to Greg's point about what's going to happen next in the Senate?
Well, let me say, just first of all, as a sidebar to all this, speaking of Mitch McConnell, while the House was voting on impeachment this week, McConnell was getting through another 12 federal judge appointments, conservative judges. He got through the Senate this week while all this was going on in the House with impeachment. I think, in a funny way, and Dan, I'd be curious to hear what you think. I, in a funny way, that the House's best leverage at the moment is Donald Trump himself, because he is so aching to have a trial, a full trial, that you know, he, according to many reports, he and McConnell are at loggerheads because McConnell wants to get this over and done with and taken care of, and you know, nothing to see here, folks. Whereas Trump really wants to be vindicated somehow and wants to have witnesses and so forth and so on, which McConnell's opposed to. And I think this may actually work ultimately to the Democrats' advantage.
Mm-hmm. And Dan Frumkin, I know you said we're talking too much about process here, not enough about the underlying high crimes and misdemeanors, but what is your take about leverage that the House may have over the Senate, over Senate Majority Leader McConnell that Greg was raising?
Well, first, I want to give Greg credit for a really great question here, because I do think that the sort of the jaded Washington press corps is so used to Mitch McConnell, so used to the incredible power that he has over the Senate and the incredible way he abuses that power, that they don't think it's really a story anymore. And I think it is. I think we should focus a lot more on Mitch McConnell. I think he's an extraordinarily important and significant figure here. And I do hope that if nothing else, this sort of puts the spotlight on him, because I don't think he will look well under it. I just have to disagree a little bit with Michael. I don't think the House has any leverage here. I think they've got maybe a few news cycles worth of coverage, but I don't think they have any leverage. I'm very interested, however, in what role the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts will play. I was just going back and looking at some of the footage from the Clinton trial, and I don't know if people remember this, but at the top of the dais was not the Senate Majority Leader, but William Rehnquist in this hysterically funny robe he has with those three stripes on it that he just came up with, and he was running the proceedings. And so John Roberts does have leverage, and I think it'd be interesting to see whether he says. He steps in and says, look, this has to be run the right way.
Although, of course, then Chief Justice Rehnquist, of course, famously said that regarding the impeachment proceedings, he did nothing in particular, and he did it pretty well. That was his assessment. So it seems unlikely that we're going to be getting much of an activist role, I think, from Chief Justice Roberts if precedent.
On the other hand, Roberts, you know, when you talk to people in Washington about the current court and so forth, what you keep hearing is that Roberts has a real belief in the necessity to preserve the sanctity of the court as an institution and the sanctity of the role of the Chief Justice.
So we'll see what happens. Unfortunately, we're just out of time. I hate to cut the conversation off. This has been a great discussion. But I want to thank our guests. So Michael Winship, Senior Writing Fellow at the website Common Dreams, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Dan Frumkin, Founder of Press Watch, thank you for being here as well.
A pleasure.
And I want to thank all of you, our listeners, for tuning in. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcasts, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. You can follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I want to thank all of you for joining us and all of our guests as well. We'll stay tuned for another week, more coverage of the news here on KALW. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and it's your call.